is an issue that I think is one of the greatest challenges, if not the greatest one of our time. So, Professor Sunstein, thank you.
Okay, wow, and fantastic. So many people have come. We're doing a book on this with David Weisbach, and it's a very early stage. So it'd be fantastic to hear thoughts and suggestions. I guess this is the first time we've talked about this publicly. Maybe too fearful to do that until now. And so let's see if we can make some progress, maybe. We have two starting points, which I hope won't be horribly controversial. One is we think that an international agreement to control greenhouse gases is a good idea. So the idea that the nations of the world should commit to scale back greenhouse gas emissions to some extent is sensible. Maybe more controversially, we believe in a lot of international redistribution if it can be done right. So the idea that wealthy people in wealthy countries should be sending resources to poor people in poor countries, we're enthusiastic about that. At the very least on welfareist grounds, thinking that poor people get more welfare from a given unit of money than rich people do. And so the world's welfare would be increased if there were a lot of international redistribution. So we like that. There is a widespread view, which I subscribe to until convinced otherwise by the person on my left, that on grounds of distributive and corrective justice, the United States and other wealthy countries, which have been principal contributors to the climate change problem, should be pouring more money into solving the problem than is justified by their self-interest. So I thought what many people in developing countries think, that on grounds of justice, apart from everything else, the wealthy countries should be contributing much more than their fair share to the climate change problem. I'm decreasingly satisfied with that view, even though more enthusiastic than ever about the idea that there should be an international agreement to control climate change, and there should be redistribution from wealthy people in wealthy nations to poor people in poor nations. So what I'm going to try to sort out a bit is the decreasing enthusiasm for my previously held view, which is probably of interest to no one, not even me, but to bring that into contact with what is emerging as the principal obstacle to an international agreement to control greenhouse gas emissions, which is the growing clarity of the split between the developing world and the developed world. The big story, I guess, of the last 5 years or so has been the reluctance of the United States to do anything about greenhouse gas emissions. The big story of the next 5 years, it seems clear, is the intransigence of poor nations, which are growing contributors to the problem. Okay, to get a hold of this, I think it's probably useful to put a spotlight on the following fact, which is only starting to get attention, which is that nations of the world have great disparities in the expected costs of climate change and also the expected costs of decreasing greenhouse gas emissions. The data here is disputed, and so the particulars shouldn't be taken to the bank. But as a first approximation, the United States and China would bear a large share of the economic burden from any significant attack on growth in emissions, because the United States and China account for about 40% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions now, and roughly that will be true for the near future. In fact, the United States would have borne at least half and possibly as much as 80% of the entire cost of the Kyoto Protocol, which helps explain why the United States was so nervous about accepting the agreement. For other nations, the costs were a small fraction of the cost for the United States. And those nations, signatories and ratifiers of the Kyoto Protocol, they look like they're not going to comply with their obligations. In addition to the fact that some nations would bear very serious economic burdens from, let's say, a worldwide carbon tax, and others wouldn't, it's also the case that the costs of climate change are unevenly distributed across the world. So on some projections, 2.5 degrees warming by 2100 would produce significant economic benefits to Russia. They would be net gainers. On most projections, 2.5 degrees warming by 2100, which is probably a little lower than what's anticipated from business as usual, would produce real costs to the United States, but not fantastically high costs to the United States, somewhere between a 1% GDP loss and a 3% GDP loss. That's not trivial, but it's not anything to get alarmed about. India and sub-Saharan Africa stand to lose a great deal more with crippling effects on agriculture, increases in diseases, most especially malaria, and significant numbers of premature deaths as a result of climate change. China is has less at risk. A few years ago, the Chinese government, I'm told, ran the numbers on climate change, and its conclusion was, if we get climate change of the anticipated amount, we'll be net gainers. So you can understand why China has been so reluctant to expend lots of money to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, thinking that's all cost and no benefit. The Chinese government, I'm now told, thinks they'll be net losers from climate change, but that the net loss is a much lower priority than the other problems that face a relatively poor country. So the upshot of all this is that many of the discussions by Vice President Gore and others of the climate change problem treat the world as a single actor. But in fact, it's the case that the costs of an international agreement would be much more severe from some nations than for others, and the benefits would be much greater for some nations than from others. There are really serious distributional consequences of, let's say, a uniform carbon tax that were imposed on every citizen of the world. Okay, the distributive justice claim, which I'm going to turn to now, puts corrective justice to one side and just says that the rich nations should be bearing the lion's share of the cost of climate change solutions, and those who have a lot of money, like Germany and people in the United Kingdom and the U.S., should either be paying cash to countries to mitigate climate change, help with adaptation, or more standardly should be bearing a greater share of the cost of emissions reductions by agreeing to a global emissions reduction strategy, which isn't really in their economic self-interest. It's more aggressive than would be in the self-interest of those nations. Okay, this has a lot of intuitive appeal, but I'm going to raise three objections to the distributive justice claim taken by itself as a ground for imposing special burdens on wealthy nations in connection with the climate change problem. The first problem is this, that if we agree, as two speakers today do, that international redistribution is a good idea, it's most puzzling to suggest that we should be paying a lot of money to help future poor people rather than current poor people. So there are vulnerable people all over the globe who are dying and hungry and jobless, and it's odd to think that those poor people deserve less priority than future poor people who will almost certainly be richer than they are. So if the arc of human history is any guide, People 100 years from now in sub-Saharan Africa and India will have a lot more resources and opportunities than people in Africa and sub-Saharan Africa today. This is a counterintuitive fact, but human history suggests it is a fact. If we want to redistribute resources, if distributive justice is our guide, the priority is the current poor people, not richer poor people who don't exist yet. The second problem is that if we want to help poor people in poor countries, the best way to help them is not to give them the in-kind benefit of somewhat cooler temperatures, but to give them resources that they can use however they want. So a little like thinking that the way to help poor people in the United States today is with some sort of housing subsidy rather than resources they can use however they see fit. The notion is that if redistribution is our guide, helping to cool the planet by 2100 or 2050 or so is the right approach, rather than giving people of India, people of China, people of sub-Saharan Africa resources by which they can set their own priorities seems puzzling. The third idea is the only one that's a little complicated, at least for me, and that is to suggest that that there's crudeness in climate change policy on distributive justice grounds, because, to put it in shorthand, many of the beneficiaries of the relevant policies are wealthy, and many of the people who would be burdened by the relevant policies are poor. So there's a crude fit between redistributive goals and climate change policy, I think most importantly, because poor people ought to react ambivalently to climate change reduction, not because they prefer to have resources they could use as they wish instead, the second point, but because many poor people around the world will be losers from an emissions agreement. There are two reasons for this. One is that people all over the world are now benefiting and will continue to benefit from warmer temperatures. Extremes of cold kill more people than extremes of heat, and there are recent studies suggesting that there are many people and animals, not incidentally, that are actually living that would otherwise die as a result of climate change. People in China and Russia are able not only to be wealthier as a result of increased agricultural productivity, but are also able to live healthier, longer lives because it's a little warmer than it would otherwise be. Now, this is not a claim that climate change is on not a good idea. It isn't. It's just a claim that if poor people are our focus, climate change has an awkward relationship to helping them. The second point is any emissions reduction strategy is going to increase prices. An increase in prices, unless they're accompanied by subsidies, which are unlikely to be adequately forthcoming, mean that the price of energy is going to go up, and that's going to come down especially hard on people who are poor, who will frequently lose what employment they have and otherwise just lose money. So the basic claim is that many people who would benefit from an aggressive climate change program are already doing pretty well economically, and many people who would be affected by such a program are both poor and would be hurt by it. So the upshot of all this is if we just isolate for purposes of analysis distributive justice as the goal of climate change policy, there are three problems. Why future poor people rather than current poor people? Second, why in-kind benefits rather than benefits that people can use as they see fit, allocating priorities as they choose? And third, why choose on distributive grounds a policy which will help many poor people but hurt many poor people too, and help rich people rather than having a transfer that helps poor people directly and doesn't have this complex incidence of winners and losers. Okay, I don't think this is the final point in the distributive justice claim. There are a few things that might be said in response to the remarks thus far. One points to the risk of catastrophe and suggests if it's the case that people in India and sub-Saharan Africa, let's suppose, face something that is not analytically so far from genocide as a result of climate change, as some models suggest, then at least some of the arguments just given are significantly weakened. Certainly the argument that we should be giving people monetary benefits rather than in-kind benefits is, decimated. If the claim is that people are just going to be killed if climate change is not reduced. So according to some models, there's a guy named Martin Weitzman who has a very alarming paper on the risks associated with climate change, which would come down especially hard on people in poor countries. If the catastrophic scenarios are correct, then the arguments just given are undermined, and the distributive justice claims gain some force. A second objection says that that the first best policies on distributive justice grounds involve giving money to the governments of poor countries. Inevitably, that would be the first best. You can't transfer it directly into their hands. And the governments of people in poor countries are frequently ill-motivated, incompetent, or corrupt. And that suggests that the first best distributive justice policies won't work. So it could be urged that, for all its crudeness, this is the best we can do. It's a lot better than foreign aid. That's not an implausible argument. The difficulty is that any climate change policy that involves emissions reductions or transfers or whatever is going to have to be run through those very governments. And it's not clear that the climate change policy can adequately or fully respond to the risk of corruption or inefficiency. There's another objection to the arguments just given, which has to do with feasibility, a kind of rough justice, where the argument is that what we would favor, which, mind you, is aggressive redistributive policy, is not feasible given our limited foreign aid budgets, that a climate change agreement that has redistributive features in it is more feasible and, for all its crudeness, is better than the status quo. Nothing I've said defeats that argument, but I hope I've said enough to suggest why the view that distributive justice is a weak foundation for aggressive United States efforts to combat climate change is compatible with the view that an international agreement is a good idea, and also is compatible with the view that international redistribution should be a lot more significant today than it is.
I'm going to address two other points, one about corrective justice and another about the possibility of a per capita emission scheme. I'll explain what that means in a moment. Now, let me start by backing up a little bit. And what we're criticizing is a set of views that are in the literature and in the popular press about how we should think about addressing the challenge of global warming. And as Cass was discussing, a lot of people think that the treaty should reflect redistributive concerns. And he's explained why we don't think that that's right, or at least to the extent that people have argued so far. There's another view, which is that the treaty should, an optimal global climate treaty should reflect norms of corrective justice. And as Cass mentioned earlier, the argument and these arguments are often made in conjunction, and they're a little confusing because they're overlapping, but the argument is the rich countries, the rich industrial countries should do more, first of all, because they're rich and everybody else is poor, that's the redistributive argument, and second of all, because it's their fault. That we wouldn't have this problem if it weren't for the wealthy, rich, industrialized nations like the United States and also Western European countries. So let's tease apart these arguments, and now let's just focus on the corrective justice argument. And I'll write a very complicated diagram on the phone. There's a lot of math here, so. So in the standard corrective justice argument, there's a wrongdoer and there's a victim, and the wrongdoer injures the victim and owes a remedy to the victim. And you've seen this, of course, in tort law, and those of you who studied philosophy know about this type of argument. And this is really the type of argument that underlies this claim that the wealthier industrialized nations should do more than might otherwise be appropriate, because it's their fault that global warming is a problem. Now, to focus your intuitions and to try to avoid the confusion that arises from the overlapping redistributive and corrective justice arguments, just imagine that the wrongdoer and the victim are at the same level as well. So suppose, and let's just to make everything concrete, suppose the wrongdoer is we think it's the United States and the victim is India. Imagine in a counterfactual world, India is as wealthy as the United States. It industrialized very recently. The U.S. industrialized a long time ago. When India industrialized, it industrialized in a greener way, so it hasn't contributed as much as global warming. Now going forward, we have to allocate the cost of an abatement program. And the idea is that if the United States had industrialized in such a wasteful way so much earlier, then India today would be wealthier and going forward would be still wealthier. And so therefore the U.S. has wronged India and owes India a remedy. That's the corrective justice argument, right? It doesn't have anything to do with the relative wealth of the two countries. Indeed, it would be a perfectly valid argument even if India were wealthier than the United States. Now, I think there are a number of problems with this argument. I'm going to mention four. Each of these problems by itself is not necessarily decisive, but I think if you put them together, it suggests that this is not a good way to think about how to design a climate treaty. And again, the implications for the climate treaty is that even as between equally wealthy states, the wrongdoers, the people who are the states who are at fault, will have a greater burden than the victims. Okay, the first point is that when we think of this, you know, standard relationship in the context of tort, we're thinking about individuals. So one individual hurts another. A poor individual who hurts a rich individual and is culpable has to pay a remedy. Wealth is irrelevant. It's just a matter of justice that the person who did wrong should offer some remedy to the victim. But who's the wrongdoer here? So here's the problem when you go from individuals to aggregations. So the United States is a state, it's not an individual. And there's a question of whether these corrective justice norms apply when you're talking about aggregations. The United States consists of people, the population is constantly changing. People are migrating to the United States from India as we speak. Americans are leaving. And connect this to the fact that most of the greenhouse gases in the United States can be attributed to people's activities in the past. In fact, decades ago, because these emissions go into the atmosphere and they stay there for decades and decades. And so there's something a little odd here, because what's going on is that the people who really hurt India are not us. We're not entirely us. It's a lot of people in the U.S. who died or migrated. And why should we, let's say, supposing we're acting properly, be responsible for the wrongful actions of people who are long gone? Same point can be made about India. There are lots of people in India. As Cass mentioned, you know, most of the harm from global warming is actually going to be felt by Indians living in the future, not Indians today, because most of the warming has not yet occurred, so the climatic effects have not been felt. So the people who really have a claim against Americans are future Indians, people who don't exist. And you could still say, well, we should do things in anticipation of the harm that they're going to be subjected to. But by the same token, you could say, well, we should also take into account the benefits that Americans have conferred on Indians. And those of you who are familiar with the debates about slave reparations will ring a bell, because when people in these debates about reparations for slavery and for other sorts of historic harms, people always make this argument. Okay, people who were slaves were harmed by other Americans, and maybe their descendants have inherited that harm in some respect, but it's also the case that they were benefited by other Americans who helped free them, and should that count somehow in this moral calculus? And then these debates often bog down in these very difficult empirical questions about, you know, who caused what harm and who caused what benefit. In this case, you have to think that the United States over the last decades has been, you know, generating all these greenhouse gas emissions. It's also been doing good things for other states and also bad things for other states. And the question is, are we supposed to take into account all these good and bad things as we figure out how to write things under the principles of corrective justice? Another problem is the causation problem, which is, you know, in tort law, you have to prove causation. In the case of climate change, it's very difficult to prove causation. We know in a general sense that Americans in the past have emitted greenhouse gases that will affect Indians in the future, but whether it's really us as opposed to other people is a much more complicated question. And finally, and probably most importantly, is culpability. So the usual idea in corrective justice is that the victim only has a remedy if the wrongdoer, well, did wrong, was it actually a wrongdoer rather than somebody who acted innocently. And here again, all kinds of odd implications seem to arise from the corrective justice approach. For one thing, you know, there are all these Americans. It's not the United States that acted culpably. It's all these Americans who've been running their refrigerators and driving their cars over the last several decades. And you have to ask yourself, was there something culpable about doing those things? Is there something wrongful about turning on the lights or turning on the heat? At a minimum, we could say there's nothing wrongful about doing those things back in the days before some kind of scientific consensus about the problem of global warming emerged. And even since then, you know, normally, if you take something like the hand formula, the proper way of thinking about this would not be to say people should never engage in any activities that create greenhouse gas emissions, right? Nobody seems to think that. The normal way of thinking about this is that you shouldn't sort of frivolously or wastefully produce greenhouse gas emissions. So you should perhaps drive when it's very important for you to drive, but when it's somewhat less important for you, you should take into account the social costs on other people that are caused by your emissions. Well, nobody really thinks like that. It's hard to say that people ought to think like that, or at least until recently they ought to. And although now people are beginning to think like that, this just raises yet another complicated problem, which is, should we punish the Americans who have been less wasteful on account of the Americans who have been more wasteful by holding the United States itself as culpable for the problem of global warming? You might say, well, if a particular Americans were not negligently emitting greenhouse gases over the last few years, at least we could say that the U.S. government has been culpable for not taking a more active role in leading the international community in adopting some kind of a climate treaty. But again, the U.S. government is just a concept. It's just a fiction. And if you're going to punish the U.S. government of the United States, it means Americans will have to pay higher taxes. And was it the fault of Americans that the United States did not exercise more leadership? That's a kind of a difficult question to answer. You'd have to say, you know, did everybody who did not vote for Al Gore commit some kind of moral wrong? Well, maybe. All right. So these are the problems. And this is not to say that there's anything wrong in blaming particular Americans for being wasteful or groups of Americans for being wasteful and thinking that they owe others more on account of it. But it's such a kind of a sloppy way to think about this problem that I think that the much better approach would be to not to rely on notions of corrective justice that really don't work very well at the level of the nation state as opposed to the level of individuals, and to think about a climate treaty from a purely welfarist perspective. Okay, my final point now is about the per capita idea. And this is a little bit complicated, and I want to leave time for questions. So let me be very brief. Suppose we get to the point where we negotiate a climate treaty. What's the climate treaty going to look like? So most economists think that what a climate treaty should do is it should create a worldwide carbon tax. And just to simplify everything very greatly, so when you drive and you buy a gallon of gas to drive, there should be some tax that will reflect the social cost in terms of climate effects of your driving. And let's just say arbitrarily that it's 10 cents That means this 10 cents is, you know, basically the cost to people living in India. That should be charged, and that will reduce the amount of driving and the amount of greenhouse gas emissions, and that will mitigate the effects of magnitude of climate change and its harmful effects. Now, for some reason, this is just not a popular approach politically. And politicians have more or less rejected the idea of a carbon tax. And instead, what they advocate is a cap and trade system, which is the type of system that the Kyoto Accord created. Now, the cap and trade approach says that, again, to continue with this example, if you want to buy a gallon of gas, you can't do it unless you first purchase a permit from the government or from somebody else. The permit will cost 10 cents in this example. And then you give, you know, you can, once you have the permit, you can burn the gallon of gas. And at least if everything can be done correctly, it'll have more or less the same effect as a carbon tax. There are reasons for thinking that this is a less effective way of going about this than a carbon tax, but, you know, it's probably pretty close. And then this would be done then at a global scale. The international community would determine how many permits are optimal, and then a price would be set, and people could buy them and trade them. Now, the permit system raises a question that, for odd reasons, the tax system does not, which is that how should the permits initially be allocated? So initially, there are going to be trillions of dollars worth of permits. And people say, well, the most natural and intuitively appealing way of distributing the permits is to do it on a per capita basis. So China would get about a sixth of the permits, and India would get about a sixth of the permits, and the U.S. would get about a 20th of them, and so on and so forth. In other words, each state would get permits in proportion to its population. Why does this approach seem appealing? Well, I think a lot of people say, look, you know, the atmosphere is like a global commons. It's turned out people at one point thought that its ability to absorb pollutants, including greenhouse gases, was unlimited. It turns out that it's limited. We have to divide it up some way. It just seems like the natural way to divide it up would be to give an equal portion to each individual. And since we live in a state system, you give it to the governments on the basis of their population. A lot of people also think that this is appealing because of its redistributive effect. So the United States would get, as I said, about 1/20th of the world's permits, whereas India would get a sixth. Well, in the U.S., people consume a lot more energy than in India. So in the end, Americans would have to buy a lot of permits from Indians, so a lot of money would go from the United States to India, which seems to conform with our notions of redistributive justice. Okay, let me mention three problems and then I'll sit down. The first problem is there's this funny oddity that we should shake your intuitions a little bit to the extent that you find this approach appealing. That is, remember how I said before that the cap and trade system and the carbon tax approach are supposed to be roughly equivalent. When people talk about the carbon tax approach, it's always an unstated assumption that the country that levies the tax will get to keep the revenues. So the U.S. would impose a 10 cents a gallon gas tax on top of whatever the additional tax is, and that money would just go into America's treasury. Under the permit regime, in effect, America, rather than taking this money and putting it in the treasury, would give most of it to India and some other countries. And the question is, why does that seem odd when we talk about an ordinary tax, but natural when we talk about the permit regime? Okay. The second point is whether the permit regime is really fair. Another strange thing about the permit regime is that the per capita approach is it isolates one effect of a climate treaty, that is the fact that by instituting these permits you raise a lot of cash that has to be done, you know, you have to do something with it. But if you think of fairness as requiring that you divide evenly the benefits of this treaty regime, there's no particular reason to think that that would result in the per capita approach. Because remember, as Cass mentioned, the beneficial effects of a climate treaty would be unequally distributed. They'd be much higher for Bangladesh than they would be for Russia. And if we want, and then the abatement costs would also, you know, vary. So if we wanted to, you know, take this surplus and divide it evenly, we would take into account the benefits that the state would obtain, as well as its abatement costs. And there's no reason to think that the types of cash transfers that would be necessary so that everybody benefited equally from a climate treaty would be the same as what you get in this per capita system. Relatedly, is that the per capita system doesn't really have any close connection to notions of redistributive justice. It's true that what it does is it doesn't favor poor states over rich states. It favors large states over small states, right? So India does well not because it's poor, but because it's large. And the United States does poorly not because it's small, it's not, but because, it does poorly just because, just compared to its current energy consumption. But if you focused on small countries like Botswana, they're going to do badly in a per capita regime because they don't have a big population. And in fact, there's no relationship between the population size of countries and their wealth. So there's no reason to think that a per capita regime, which tends to favor large states, will also favor poor states. And then there's a final point, which is probably the decisive point, which is that it's just not a feasible approach. Any climate change treaty, in my view, and Cass and I have some discussions about this still, it's going to have to make every state better off according by its own light. So every state is going to have to think, I'm going to enter into this treaty because I'm worse off if I'm not in this treaty. This is perfectly possible because we know that a treaty will generate a surplus. That is, climate change is creating a lot of costs which are greater than the abatement costs. But and there are lots of ways this surplus could be divided. But the per capita scheme would basically require the United States to pay hundreds of billions of dollars, probably, to other countries every year. Whereas its foreign aid expenditures right now are in the $10 to $20 billion range. And it's not just the United States, it's other wealthy countries as well. It's just not realistic to think that the U.S. will be willing to do that. So I think that's a big problem with the per capita system. So our comments today have been mainly negative. But as Cass said at the beginning, we are very much in favor of a climate treaty. And we're still working on how we think the treaty should be designed in light of these criticisms that we've advanced. We haven't said anything about that yet, but we'd be happy to talk about it in the question and answer session. So we'd be happy to take questions.
Whereby there are also unilateral mechanisms permitted on the side for additional
control. A lot of what on the side?
Unilateral or bilateral mechanisms for additional control.
Well, I think there has to be a global multilateral treaty because this is basically a collective action problem, and all states have to have an obligation to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions. I haven't thought about whether, I think side payments would be fine, and as for other types of bilateral cooperation or regional cooperation, I don't see any problem.
Here's a statistic for you. The Kyoto Protocol, which was the governing, the world's leading document, by probably the most reputable calculation would have reduced anticipated climate change by 2100, by guess how much? Where the anticipated increase would be 3 or 4 C. The reduction would be by 0.03 C. The Kyoto Protocol would reduce by 2100, anticipated warming by 0.03 C. That's a remarkable number, yes? It's really low. The Kyoto Protocol would have done very little by that calculation. Some calculations suggest that it would have been maybe triple that. Maybe somewhere close to 1 C on some estimates, but that's high end. That's how could that be? It's that all the leading greenhouse gas contributors have to be included. And that's, I feel less confident, and you can see our tentativeness in this kind of niggling effort to explore the various principal concrete claims being ventured, less confident about what the agreement should look at than clear on why it's close to intractable. That if the United States acts unilaterally, we might,
our contribution to reduced warming will be, as a first approximation, 0.00C. If we do what the Democrats and Republicans might be unified on, or even more than that, the reduced warming by 2100 from our unilateral action will be trivial. If we and China get together, now we're talking a bit. So that bilateral negotiation might be helpful. But if we in the UK and Germany talk, then it's looking more like Kyoto, which is pretty pitiful.
Getting to like the intransigence of the United States and other wealthy countries, like what are some of the best or most plausible ideas that you all have on how to get over that problem and how to get over the problem that we're not going to be that harmed, this means very implement and any plausible or effective global warming regime has to impose substantial costs both on the United States and on other countries like us?
Well, there are three things that could be done. One is, my favorite is the availability heuristic. If there are salient events that are really alarming, then people's assessments realign. So if on September 8th, 2001, someone said, let's have the U.S. Patriot Act, and let's have lots of security steps in airports, that would have been borderline insane, yes? And then on September 12th, everyone wanted that. Almost everyone wanted that. So if there are salient events, that can motivate change. That's the first. The second is, if our assessment, apart from availability of the costs of corrective measures, switches, so it looks like small stuff, then that can change. So that can change behavior. So one reason, the Kyoto Protocol, mind you, this wasn't Bush who walked away from it. Guess how many Democratic senators supported the U.S. ratification of the Kyoto Protocol? Answer, zero, not one. There was unanimous disapproval of ratification of the Kyoto Protocol. And that was not senseless. Maybe it was wrong, but it wasn't senseless. The reason why it wasn't senseless is it would have cost the U.S. a lot and delivered for the U.S. and the world not so much. So if we can have something that will reduce costs, either a relatively low initial carbon tax, say, or a cap and trade program that looks like it's going to spur innovation, fine. The asset deposition statute enacted under Bush 1, it turned out to be not very costly because the market mechanism was extremely successful at driving down costs. So availability heuristic 1, low cost 2, high benefits 3. And high benefits can be generated through new analyses that suggest, as this Weizmann study does, that the likelihood of catastrophe is sufficiently high that this can't be overlooked, or that the earlier projections from a few years ago of 1 to 3% GDP loss for the U.S. are much too low. So a little anecdote for you. I can see what you're looking for, and I'll give you one that points a possible way forward. The Montreal Protocol, truly successful ozone protective treaty, was pushed hardest by the United States under Ronald Reagan. How can that be? That Ronald Reagan, the least environmentally aggressive American president, was the world's leader on ozone-depleting chemicals. It's not because this was his intuitions were environmentalist, nor is it because the availability heuristic got to him, as it typically did. He loved an anecdote. None of the anecdotes got to him on this. But the Council of Economic Advisors said at a key meeting, look, it's going to cost us $21 million to phase out ozone-depleting chemicals, and the benefits dwarf that in terms of skin cancers averted and cataracts. And Reagan said, okay, sounds like a good idea. And there, by the way, almost every Republican in the United States Senate supported the Montreal Protocol. So it completely flipped Kyoto, because the technocrats assessed the problem very differently.
Speaking of technocratic assessments, what is your assessment, if we were to, say, price a carbon tax or reduce the cost of a cap and trade system to the per gallon of gas excise tax that you would have to charge to finance this, what would that be, and how would that money be spent now to perhaps mitigate the effects of war?
Well, this is just wild guesswork because so much is unknown. But I think that reasonably respectable economists think that it would be in the range of, 10-20 cents a gallon. It wouldn't be that much. But even that is hard to do. That from the global warming point of view, all that you should be concerned about is imposing that tax. It doesn't matter what you do with the money as long as you don't use it to just subsidize other energy intensive activities. But you could use that money to lower other taxes or to fund another war somewhere else or whatever you want. But as long, right? So you can do anything with the money that you want. But there'll be a big economic cost because a lot of everybody depends on cars and they will feel poorer as a result. But the benefits would swamp those costs.
I have a question, sort of along two dimensions. Use neutrality. We don't care how people are using energy under any of these agreements. So you might expect, especially growing countries like China, they'd be using it to build up their infrastructure, whereas in more developed countries, especially like in Europe, you'd expect them to use it, a higher percentage of it, towards getting greener energy sources and that kind of thing. And similarly, enforcement, how are you going to enforce this down the line? So I'm wondering, between those two things, if we were to do taxes or cap and trade, if we're transferring all this money to China and India, and they use this to build up a dirty industry, and then at 50 years down the line, now they don't want to be held to the agreement like the United States doesn't want to be held. How do we balance those two things?
Those are great questions, really great questions. The enforcement problem is very serious. So one reason the U.S. has been intransigent is a thought that the developing countries are excluded by their own insistence, and that means the benefits would be low. And even if the agreement includes enough nations to make a difference, the Kyoto Protocol doesn't have any serious sanctioning mechanism. So I think any treaty has to have two things. First, a clear mechanism for external monitoring, and second, very serious trade or other sanctions for nations that have violated the terms. Now, there's a model here and a reason for optimism. The model is the Montreal Protocol, where there are similar concerns about enforcement, and the trade sanction mechanism has worked. So ozone-depleting chemicals, very close to eliminated worldwide as a result. The other reason for optimism is that, at least in some domains, in environmental protection, once we've had aggressive regulatory mechanisms in place, people innovate. So for ozone-depleting chemicals, all of the projections were that this was going to cost a fortune. And the company said so, the EPA said so. Once the regulation kicked in, there was innovation. So I think the great hope for climate change is that either unilateral action by the United States or other countries, otherwise hard to defend, could spur innovation, which will drive down costs, and that would reduce the enforcement problem.
Yeah. Well, wouldn't you expect the long-term rise in price of traditional energy sources to spur such innovation anyway?
Absolutely. But the question is, if you have a cap and trade program or even a tax program, how do we know that other countries are going to be abiding by that? And what is the mechanism to ensure that they do?
You need innovation beyond what would be provoked just by normal reduction of the easy to reach fuels, and so there has to be some legal framework above and beyond that.
Yeah. Notwithstanding this point that you're making and that I'm making, it's good to be careful with it. I talked to a guy who led one of the International Panel on Climate Change's working groups, who's a scientist who really knows all the scientific details. And I said to him, the case you make is formidable, that the harms are serious and need to be redressed. But the costs of stabilizing to the degree that he personally wants are very high, yes? And for China and India, poor countries, the internal assessment just makes that very difficult, and so too for the United States. What do you think about that, I asked him. And he said, once the regulation is in, they'll innovate. The costs will disappear. But that would be very surprising if it worked out that easily, especially with energy. The ozone-depleting chemicals, which were in devices that were much less important, air conditioners and such, it doesn't have the dailiness of climate of greenhouse gas problem.
With any sort of regime, you're going to be transferring a lot of money into the third world. Are you concerned that they might be fighting over it? I mean, like, you're dumping a lot of money on countries that don't necessarily have the best government.
Yeah, that's certainly an extremely serious problem. And in the foreign aid literature, I think the conventional wisdom is that foreign aid, even though trillions has been spent, hasn't had much of an effect, in part because the governments in these countries are corrupt and unrepresentative and often just incompetent, even if well-meaning. This is a big problem, because under a cap-and-trade system, you would probably end up giving permits to these governments, which would then supposedly distribute them or auction them off to local industries. But the governments would have to commit to, you know, shutting down or sanctioning any industries that did not have permits. And they may be simply unable to do that. They may just lack the capacity to do that, or it might be easy to bribe them and so forth. And then in addition, they're going to get a lot of money from selling these permits. And if they waste foreign aid resources, then they may very well waste this money as well. So this is a tremendously difficult problem.
I worry about that, but there's one thing I worry more about, which is the developing countries' insistence on distributional equity and corrective justice is making a worldwide agreement increasingly difficult in a way that is especially harmful to them. So we haven't talked about the appropriate design of the agreement which we agreed the world should sign, but the irony here is that the insistence on justice-type arguments is hurting the prospects for an agreement which is least dispensable from the standpoint of those very nations that are pressing the arguments.
There was one back there.
This is completely going on the web, so but if our problems are intransigence and just the fact that we might not get anything done ever, might there not be an advantage to trying something after the model of GATT? In the sense of just continual negotiations and continual small reductions as a gesture of goodwill and just starting the process going?
Absolutely. I think it's already started. There have been these, you know, cycles of negotiations going on since the 90s. And they've made a little bit of progress, not very much. I suspect that is the model that will be used, at least to some extent. Well, Kyoto was a protocol that was based on an earlier framework convention. So I think you might think of Kyoto as like a round, like a trade round. And it didn't work because it was in somewhat, well, as Cass was saying, it put so much of a burden on the United States that the U.S. wasn't willing to go along with it. Plus, and what's become even more clear of the problem now than it was then, is you have to have the developing nations agree to binding commitments as well. And that's going to be the biggest challenge over the next few years.
Okay, along these lines of gestures of good faith that might overcome the world's intransigence, I predict, a prediction, that in the next 5 years, we're going to have a domestic cap-and-trade program in the United States. In fact, I think there's probably at least a 20% chance that we're going to have that under Bush. Not as much as 50%, but at least 20%. And the reason it's 20% and maybe higher is that companies are pushing for it, thinking we'll get something better from their point of view under Bush than we get under a Democratic president. And so they're saying, let's try it. Head meaning, you know, reflection says that we Americans, whatever our moral commitment should be, ambivalent about a domestic cap and trade program because it'll put some real economic pressure on people, and that always hurts poor people most. And it will produce hardly any benefits. For the U.S., no benefits, and from the world, hardly any benefits. So that's not good. But Hart says that if the U.S. adopts a unilaterally a cap and trade program, that might be the necessary spur to getting developing country involvement. It's a hope. It's a gamble. For ozone-depleting chemicals, we did this. The U.S. had an aggressive restriction on ozone-depleting chemicals that were purely domestic, and that had a tremendous worldwide impact. Because the U.S. did it, it showed good faith, and it showed the costs were not that high. But the latter point is crucial, because domestically our reductions and bans on ozone-depleting chemicals weren't economically harmful, the cap and trade programs were expensive, and produced significant unilateral benefits. This wouldn't. But if a certain former University of Chicago professor is pushing for the domestic cap and trade program, we're not going to refuse to vote for him for that reason.
I think that is unfortunately all we have time for. Thank you very much.